Good morning. Welcome to Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster. I'm Stephanie Regal sitting in today for Jim. And we have some interesting guests here filling us in on what's going on in the city. First up is Darryl Gissel, the new chief administrative officer for the city parish of Baton Rouge, working with Mayor Sharon Weston Broom, who was his competitor in last year's mayor's race, but now he's bringing a lot of order and discipline to her team. If you have a question for Darryl, please call in at 297-5633 in the Baton Rouge area or outside of Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757. Well, Darryl, welcome to Talk Louisiana. Thanks for rushing over here this morning. It's already been an early morning for you. You know, there was talk maybe right after the election that you might be up for this position, and you said absolutely not, and the mayor said absolutely not, and 10 months later, here you are. Right. What happened and what changed?
I've tried to do whatever I could to help the mayor in the new administration, and I went to talk to the mayor, I guess, two, three months ago now about blight of all things, which I know was an issue of great importance. Middle of the conversation, the mayor said, could I change the topic? She said, it's no secret that I'm looking for a CAO. I've looked long and hard. And she said, would you ever consider doing this? And my basic statement was, I'll be there if that's what you choose. I said, but whoever you pick needs to be somebody who you can have full trust and faith in and you feel comfortable with. And I stressed that over and over and over again. And that's really how it happened. I think we got to know one another during the campaign, through the transition, and I think we both have the same view of Baton Rouge, and that is that if we want to bring the community together, we need to make sure that the whole community is served. I mean, we've got a big government, we have a lot of capability, and I think we know from past history that each end of the community has different needs. North Baton Rouge has redevelopment needs. The newer parts of the parish have huge issues based on growth, traffic, transportation, et cetera. So I think we share the same vision, and it's been a wonderful working relationship.
Darryl, you were, and maybe still are, you ran as an independent or a no-party candidate, but your experience in politics was as a Republican. And when you were very young, you ran the Republican Party for Louisiana. Is it different working in a Democratic administration?
No, not at all. I think our goals are the same. The mayor's great to work with, and I have to say that I'm amazed by her energy level. I feel like I have a lot of energy. People have always laughed at me. I'm the ever-ready battery. I told her one night, not in these terms, but I basically told her she had whipped my butt in terms of workforce. I talked to her one night at 11 o'clock when she was at a function at Harvard, 11 o'clock at night, and she happened to mention that she got up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get to the airport on time to leave. She was still going strong at 11 o'clock at night. And this isn't just fluff. I mean, she's there working hard every day at running government.
What was the biggest need you saw when you came into this administration that admittedly had some missteps in its first 9 months? What did you see as the biggest need and maybe that you could bring to it?
I think just trying to help support the mayor. Again, the volume of work that comes in that office is absolutely unbelievable. And I think for any new administration, it takes a lot to understand how it all functions. I mean, amazed by the things that come into that office for the mayor's signature. It could be a supplemental pay document for a fireman in Zachary. It's just amazing. And it's trying to understand the procedures of how it all works and why it goes where it goes.
297-5633 if you have a question for Chief Administrative Officer Darryl Gissel, or 877-217-5757. And I know, Darryl, in previous administrations, I mean, Walter Mansour really, you know, ran the city for Kip at Holden very successfully during the first term. And William Daniel, you know, really did a good job handling just the nuts and bolts and putting in the elbow grease. Are you doing that?
Absolutely. Yeah. But I'm doing it hand in hand with the mayor. Yeah. You know, we've been through the budget cycle, which was a real interesting eye-opener in terms of where our money comes from and where it goes to and how it's divided up. I think $819 million overall budget. But actually, the part that the city government really controls is about $319 million. The money is dedicated money to BREC, to the library board, to all those different independent taxing districts.
And then what about, because I think this is an important point, I know you put together a PowerPoint for the Metro Council at the beginning of that budget process a few weeks back that was very informative. I don't think people understand not only how much money is dedicated to other agencies, like you just referenced, but the money that has to go to the pension system. I mean,
oh,
it's
exactly.
Huge. We're drowning in that pension debt.
56% of the payroll dollars go for employee benefits. I mean, that is huge for any entity to support that, and that doesn't include vacation and sick leave.
Wow.
So recruitment and retention of employees becomes an issue. You know, the older employees who are there came aboard in a system where they really were concerned about those retirement benefits. What every department head has stressed over and over and over and over again is that recruiting people to work in city government is a huge issue. And the new workers really aren't concerned about the end result, the end retirement benefits. They want high pay in the beginning. And we have a system that is not set up that way at all. So recruiting is a huge issue, not just for police, but for all of the other departments that we have.
And so, like, of the $819 million overall budget, mm-hmm. is it 56% of that goes to pension? Or is that money that can be spent?
Well, no. The 56% is really just having to do with the payroll dollars.
The payroll dollars.
Yes.
Okay.
But when you look at the city budget and you start looking at the part that the city council basically has some control over, or the mayor, $319 million, if I remember exactly, 93% or 56% of those dollars actually go for public safety. So okay. When you look at policing in terms of a new police chief, that person's job is huge. They control a $93 million budget.
That is huge.
So,
well, certainly police chief is a hot topic at the moment. Several candidates still
yes.
sort of under consideration, being interviewed by a committee the mayor put together.
We started with 11 candidates. You know, people have talked about, oh, we need to look outside. We need to do all these highbrow things in terms of picking a police chief. But the mayor actually is harnessed a little bit in terms of where she can look, and that the candidates have to take a test, and there's a state board that has to give the test and then certify the applicants. So our pool of candidates started with 11 people. Three of those candidates decided that they did not want to go forward with interviews, and then one more dropped out. So we started with 11 candidates. We're now down to 7.
Okay.
The mayor insisted that the process be open in terms of trying to bring the community together on policing. She knows probably better than anyone in Baton Rouge that the community is divided. You have areas where there's distrust toward policing, and we saw that during the episodes of the summer of 2016. And her main goal is to try and make certain that the communities that need help, where there's high crime, that they have a great relationship with the police department. That is very tough to do in this national climate where there's so much distrust and division in policing. So the mayor insisted, in order to do that we have a very open process in selecting a chief. She wants the public engaged in the process. So the way she set this up, there's a 14-member committee that actually has been conducting interviews, open interviews and open meetings, where the public can come make comments and see what's going on. The interviews have actually been broadcast through the city's Metro 21 station. And that committee on Thursday night will basically vote to send the mayor 5 names of the 5 people that they feel like she should interview in making her final decision.
Okay. And I know, I mean, you talk about the divisions in the community, but rightly or wrongly, one of the criticisms that you know, was leveled at her early on was that she wanted to pick an African-American police chief because she is an African-American. That was the perception out in parts of Southeast Baton Rouge Parish, East Baton Rouge Parish. Is that what it was about? Not true.
Very unfair perception. I think that, you know, this mayor is about bringing people together, not dividing us. And I think she's made that very clear. And I think that she understands that you have to work in bringing both groups together.
So what is her mandate for this new chief, whichever of the 5 candidates it will ultimately be?
I think she wants to make certain that we use the best 21st century policing models. Again, this new chief will control a $93 million budget. If I remember the figure correctly, there are 885 people in that department that this chief will supervise. And it has to be somebody who understands policing, but also someone who's a firm and good manager.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a unionized police department. And that creates some issues in terms of how you operate. And needless to say, that chief is going to have to bring all the groups together.
And what's going on with crime in the city parish right now?
We've had that spike in crime, and that spike in crime actually started back in November of 2016. Johnny Dunham, who is the interim police chief, has put a lot of new programs in place, and we've started to see a reduction in those crime numbers. They started dropping in September. I think the high spike that we saw was basically related to drug activity and domestic violence. Hmm. We've seen some of those domestic cases, which are horrible. And Johnny's done some interesting things. We actually have a domestic violence liaison from the police department who's working with the DA's office, and they're monitoring the domestic violence cases as they go through the court system to try and help make sure that people have the help they need and that we can tamper down some of the domestic violence issues. He's reorganized the department, put more people in the streets in those high-crime areas.
Well, I want to hear more about that, Daryl, but we are going to go to a quick break. Stay right there, and we'll have more of Daryl Gissel when we come right back. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. I'm Stephanie Regal, sitting in this morning for Jim Engster, and we're visiting some more with Daryl Gissel, Chief Administrative Officer for the City Parish. If you have a question for Daryl, you can call in at 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. And Daryl, you were talking to us about some of the measures that Interim Police Chief Johnny Dunham has implemented just in the past couple of months to try to get a handle on the crime that had spiked up over the summer.
Mm-hmm. Again, we have somebody working in domestic violence who is actually a liaison who's working with the DA's office to monitor domestic violence issues as they go through the court system. Domestic violence has been a huge uptick in those numbers. And drug activity. The department's working with the U.S. Attorney's Office in terms of some different crime measures there. They've reassigned some of the street patrol units in those high crime areas. The city's actually targeting blighted houses in areas of high crime where the blighted houses have actually been creating some of the issues on their own, drug havens.
Well, and speaking of blight, that's a huge issue in the city, and your administration is making some changes in that area?
Yes.
Sort of reorganizing the way the Redevelopment Authority and the Office of Community Development work together, and the mayor named a new head of the RDA, Chris Tyson, right. Very talented lawyer and community activist here.
Right. Blight is a huge issue for me, and again, I said before, that's really the thing that brought me to this position. I went to have a discussion with the mayor about blight. As one who's worked in downtown Baton Rouge and that whole rebirth for 30 years, blight was a huge issue that we had back in the 80s, mm-hmm. and we could never get the city to understand that blighted houses created crime, and they also basically were destructive to neighborhood fabrics. So it's been a long, long-standing issue in Baton Rouge. There are new programs in place that the mayor's implemented to tear some of these houses down quicker. We've had a huge backlog of houses that need to be torn down. But
so is it more like streamlining the process, in other words, just to expediting
the demolition? But the big issue is you can tear down a house, but what goes in its place? Mm-hmm. If you just tear down a house and you have a vacant lot that becomes weed-infested, infested with rodents, and then people start dumping trash in those lots, you really haven't improved anything.
Right.
You probably perpetuated the situation. So we know that in order to make blight, to clean up blight, it has to be a holistic approach. The RDA is a huge part of that fabric. We need help redeveloping some of these areas.
And I know the RDA, I mean, this was one of their initial charges they started working on back in 2008. Mm-hmm. The city transferred a couple of hundred adjudicated lots to the RDA. Some of those lots still haven't been redeveloped, but we're talking 10 years, and we're only talking like 150 lots. That's like a drop of water in the ocean.
Right.
How do you?
Absolutely. You know,
what's going on over there?
What people have to understand is in some of these older neighborhoods where you have families that where a family member has died, you have heirship issues. You may have one of those properties that may have a $5,000 value, but it's got 50 heirs to it. Mm-hmm. Once that happens, then you have a real nightmare on your hand. You have blight, basically. No one can improve the property because they don't have clear title to it. They can't sell the property. And in many cases, someone will quit paying the taxes, and then the city gets the property back on adjudicated tax roll. So it's a long process. And in some of these neighborhoods, you have huge number of houses in that condition.
So are any of these programs that you reference, addressing that issue?
They're big issues. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the RDA has some ability to sidestep some of those issues. They can take the adjudicated properties through some of the processes that they have access to and help get those properties back on the market. You may still have some title issues. There are mm-hmm. lots of legal things that come into play. I think where the RDA ran into a problem was they acquired some of those properties in the process. They didn't have enough funding to even keep the lots cleared, to keep them cut. And then they struggled to find the people to go in and redevelop. I think the lots that you're talking about now basically have been set up for someone to go in and do redevelopment.
And Habitat for Humanity's done some of them and a couple
right.
of, you know.
We actually have a private company that is looking very hard at coming into some of these areas. They want to acquire as many of those lots as they possibly can to build houses on. The question is, how do they get enough inventory to make it work for them? It's easy to go in and build a subdivision,
right?
But it's much tougher to go out and do scattered site housing.
Interesting.
So
one of the other big issues on the table right now is the industrial tax exemption. The mayor
yes.
has set up a committee with representatives from agencies across the
right.
city parish that receive property tax revenues to determine how to mm-hmm. handle this. Where is that process right now?
Well, to back up a little bit, the governor has basically insisted that tax exemptions don't just get rubber stamped.
Mm-hmm.
So the process now is that each local governing authority will have to basically sign off on those tax exemptions before they're given. And the problem from a business standpoint is the businesses want to know coming in that they don't have to deal with five different entities. They
sure.
kind of want a matrix of what we expect. And I think the expectation is that we want to make sure that those tax exemptions go for the creation of new jobs and that you don't just give a tax exemption on refurbishing old equipment. You want to make sure that tax exemptions are used the best way that what they're meant to do. So the mayor has actually, by executive order, created a committee with a representative of the sheriff's office, the school board, the metro council, and the mayor has one representative too. They will basically create a matrix to try and help all of the different groups decide what we should be looking for to add some stability into the process. And then each group will then have to go back and approve the tax exemptions on their own.
And when does that all take place?
We hope to have the first meeting before the end of December.
So that's very soon.
Yes.
Okay. Michael is on the line for you, Daryl. Michael has a question? Nope.
Hey, Michael.
Michael doesn't? Oh, well. Sorry. Bye, Michael. Okay. Well, another thing that's going on over at City Hall is the plan of government.
Yes.
And the Metro Council is taking a look at this. Should we expect any major changes to come out of this? I know the business community is sort of anxiously looking at it.
The committee actually has its second meeting today. I think they go through the first two chapters of the charter.
Is the mayor pushing for any major, substantive or systemic changes?
We haven't actually formalized anything right now, but I mean, certainly there are some issues there. If you remember, this mayor had what amounted to about a 20-day transition period.
Mm-hmm.
Just the timing in terms of when a mayor takes office is really tough. How do you transfer from one administration to another with a 20-day window? That's
right.
basically impossible.
Right. So what comes of that remains to be seen,
yes.
I guess, at this point. Okay. Still hearing talk out there that St. George is going to make a move to incorporate sometime maybe early next year. I think they'll have a smaller footprint than they tried last time. What are you all hearing on this, and what are you all doing to try to maybe reach out to this group or fight this group like the previous administration did through annexing properties?
I think the mayor's actually been in open discussions with people from St. George, trying to make certain that their needs are being met and they feel more comfortable about where we are as a city and parish.
I know this is an issue that you're very passionate about, and this
yes.
is one of the reasons you got, so involved.
Right. And I think the mayor is passionate about that. She, above all, wants to make sure that we stay united. And I think part of staying united is what the mayor understands, that each area has different needs, and that as a leader, it's imperative that we make certain that each group feels served.
What happens if they are successful this time?
Well, I think the argument's always been that if you if you break up our form of government, if you divide things up, that economically it's devastating to each group, that the cost of government just goes through the roof. Mm-hmm. People's taxes go up, services are affected. We have a unified form of government, and it, while our government entity was set up way back, I think probably in the 50s or whatever, early, it is a model that people have moved toward. I mean, it's seen as an efficient way of governing. And I think we need to make certain that, again, that we have everybody feel like their needs are being met.
Mm-hmm. And with respect to schools, I know that the mayor campaigned on doing what she could to improve education, even though we know that a mayor really can't do much to improve education.
The mayor has actually been aggressively involved in that. I think, again, she's at a function this morning. I took her place at a chamber function because she's doing a thing with educational leaders this morning. I think the mayor has a bully pulpit. And part of what the mayor has done is to pull all the educational leaders in, the colleges, the community colleges, the school board, the charter school groups, et cetera, to come together to have open discussions on how we work together.
All right. Well, Darryl Gissel, Chief Administrative Officer for the City Parish, thank you so much for being with us today. Good luck as you continue on your endeavors.
Thanks.
Hi, welcome back to Talk Louisiana. I'm Stephanie Regal, sitting in for Jim Engster today. And if you're listening here on WRKF, you know that WRKF is in the middle of its year-end campaign. This is just a quick three-day fundraiser. And you know, WRKF is listener-supported. Listeners make up the largest portion of WRKF's budget. And if you listen to great shows like Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster, you know how important it is that people like you support the station through a tax-deductible donation. And today only, if you give by 7 p.m., you will automatically be entered into a drawing for a dinner for four at Reginelli's Pizza. So call 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753, or go to wrkf.org and click on the donate button to make your tax-deductible contribution before the end of the year. So we were with Darryl Gissel, Chief Administrative Officer for the City Parish, and now joining us for the second half of the show is Michael DiResto, Executive Vice President of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber. Michael, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine. And yourself?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for being with us today. And always lots of interesting things to talk to the Chamber about. Y'all had a regional economic survey come out today. Maybe we can get to that in a minute. But wanted to visit with you first about the Capital Region Mobility Strategy. Y'all released that strategy shortly before Thanksgiving. And, you know, there was a great strategy and a campaign in place to try to raise a gasoline tax and do some great infrastructure projects. And that didn't happen. So where are y'all now? Where is CRISIS, Capital Region Industry for Sustainable Infrastructure Solutions? And what does this new mobility strategy entail?
Sure, thanks. Yeah, you know, obviously with efforts earlier in the year at the legislature to find a mechanism to increase transportation funding, you know, that fell short. We saw in East Baton Rouge an effort to put something on the ballot to address, you know, more of the local arterials. That also fell short. But from the perspective of CRISIS, and those who are not aware of it, it kind of represents some major employers throughout kind of the five parish region with the most infrastructure and the most infrastructure needs. What we've heard from businesses and commuters and workers, you know, there's a recognition that we need to have some revenue to address some of these big ticket items, like a new way to get across the river, a new bridge. But they've also been telling us for quite some time, give us a blueprint, give us a path forward that, you know, when revenue becomes available or when we can get greater collaboration among elected leaders at the local and state level, that we'll have a path forward so that these terrible, terrible problems that we've got with traffic and congestion and road conditions can at least see some light at the end of the tunnel. And that's what this Capital Region Mobility Strategy is about. It was more than a year in the making where we were able to bring Kim Lee Horn, one of the top national transportation planning groups in the country in, do kind of collaborative outreach, stakeholder meetings, And it resulted, as you mentioned, in the release of this Capital Region Mobility Strategy, which takes a more holistic approach to addressing our problems.
So in other words, it doesn't just say, okay, we need a new bridge, we need to widen the interstate, you know, between here and there, and then we need maybe a bump or a loop or something. It talks more broadly about things like capacity and efficiency, travel choice and management, and policy and partnerships. What do those mean?
Sure. Well, first, it's a recognition that, you know, given the state of affairs in, you know, congestion and transportation gridlock in the capital region, there's no one silver bullet. You know, we've recognized, I think there's a consensus in the region that, you know, the biggest ticket item and the item that would do the most good is a new bridge across the Mississippi River. But that's a project that exceeds $1 billion in a price tag. But even with that, you know, these problems didn't come in overnight. We're not going to fix them overnight. So when we look at, you know, what's it going to take to get us out of these terrible rankings where we're the second worst mid-sized city in the country, where people in the capital region are spending over $2,000 a year because of all the problems with the roads, how are we going to move the needle on that? And more importantly, how are we going to help workers commute, help workers and citizens, you know, go about their everyday lives in a way that's far more productive than what they're experiencing today? And that's going to take, you know, it is going to take major infrastructure. Crisis was able to commission a study a couple years ago looking at all these major projects that are on the books and studying them from a cost-benefit analysis. You know, one good thing happening is the project that was identified as providing the most congestion relief for the dollar, widening I-10 and Ascension. Glad to say that state government has found the dollars. They're going to be moving forward with that. So that's progress. But it's going to take more than what these so-called mega projects can deliver. It's going to take traffic demand management, where
sure.
We've seen other cities, whether it's the big employers staggering start times or end times for their employees so that not everybody's getting on the road at the same time. Other cities do a much better job with ride-sharing programs, with, you know, making sure with technology you can connect people so not everybody's getting in their car at those peak hours at the same time. And we also look at, you know, development.
Sure.
And, you know, some of the research that our consultant helped us with is, you know, we've got bigger commute times. We're also seeing far more people, you know, living further away from where they work. And, you know, that's a great thing in terms of the growth that's taken place, specifically in like Ascension and Livingston. But how do we in the future direct growth and development in ways that it's closer to where you work, it's closer to where you shop, so that we reduce the number of people on the road?
Well, and I want to talk some more about the specifics of those strategies, but we have a couple of callers that we want to get to. Phil in Jefferson Terrace has a question for you. Good morning, Phil. You're on the line with Michael DiResto.
Good morning. Yeah, has there been any consideration about modifying that Washington Street exit? I mean, I know as you come off the bridge, there seems to be enough room to add a lane or commandeer the whole exit itself. Is that something that's been discussed?
Thank you. That has been discussed and discussed and discussed and discussed. And the good news is that the state DOTD is developing a plan. They do have funding. I don't know if you recall a year or so ago, as part of a fast lane grant that the state was able to get from the federal government, they set aside a certain portion of that money, not necessarily to close Washington Street, but they're going to open up another route coming 110 south, which they believe is going to do a lot to address that problem. You know, it's something we like to cite when we're talking to federal officials that, you know, it's the one place along the southern United States and along I-10 where a major interstate reduces down to one lane. It's not a claim to fame that we're proud of here in Baton Rouge, but it very much makes the point that something has to be done. We're very pleased that, and we believe through the advocacy of crisis that, you know, that's something that's been pinpointed as a real need, and DOTD has the dollars, and we believe in 2018 they're going to be moving forward with a plan to address the Washington Street problem.
So we think 2018 that project will actually start? Is that the point?
I don't have the specific timeline. I think they will begin their planning process for it in 2018.
Interesting. 297-5633 if you have a question for Michael DiResto about traffic and solutions, or outside the Baton Rouge area, 877-217-5757. Michael, I know you have a lot of experience in government. You were in the Division of Administration during part of Bobby Jindal's administration. Part of the big problem here is that no one is willing to pay for the projects that need to happen. And even though business and industry, the employers, the employees in this area, you know, at least in the abstract, say we have to do these things, when it comes time to voting for it, people don't want to support it. The Metro Council wouldn't even bring the mayor's green light plan 2, or whatever she calls it, you know, to the voters. And Steve Carter didn't even make his colleagues in the House of Representatives vote on the gas tax because he knew it was going to fail because they were so afraid to support it, even though this is like one issue that everybody can get behind. So what is the solution? How do we rebuild enough trust in government to get people to pay for a tax to support some of these projects?
Well, I was going to say the $64,000 question. It's more like the $500 million question. Well, first I want to make a shout out to Representative Steve Carter and many members of the Capitol Legislative Delegation who were very strong during the session in support of this. You know, it's a situation where you've got to get 70 votes, you know, a supermajority of House members. He was able to get over 60 in support, but it fell just short. And, you know, there was some surprising resistance from people in portions of the state that have real infrastructure needs, and we were very surprised about that. You know, a lot of what we heard is just the headwinds of the state fiscal situation in its entirety, the uncertainty about what other kind of tax increases are going to be needed to balance the budget. It's a problem that's not going away, and Representative Carter's been very, he's been very eloquent that, you know, you look around other states and, you know, we're a state where we don't provide any general fund revenue to our transportation department and roads. 31 other states actually supplement their funding for infrastructure out of their general fund.
Michael, hold that thought because that's really interesting, but we are going to go to a quick break. We'll be right back with Michael DiResto. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. I'm Stephanie Regal sitting in today for Jim Engster. And just a reminder that here on WRKF, we're in the middle of the year-end campaign, and tax-deductible gift goes a long way toward bringing the kind of great programming like Talk Louisiana with Jim Engster that you have come to expect on WRKF. So call 855-893-9753 or go to WRKF.org and click on the donate button to make that contribution today. And we're visiting with Michael DiResto of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber. He's talking to us about some of the plans that are in the works to try to address the area's chronic transportation infrastructure problems, the traffic, the gridlock, especially given that nobody here wants to pay for new roads and bridges. And so, Michael, you were telling us a little bit about how other states actually dedicate general funds from their state budgets to pay for some of these projects. We don't. But, I mean, the downside is that nobody wants to pass a special tax to pay for some of these projects. Have you heard any talk? I mean, the conventional wisdom last year was that this issue wasn't going to be able to come up this year, and then it wasn't going to be able to come up the next year because that's an election year. Any talk of maybe, you know, a gasoline tax or something coming back in a special session in 2018 after the regular session?
I would think that's unlikely. Mm-hmm. What we're hopeful for is you know, to accentuate the point to lawmakers down at the Capitol, when we see, you know, 31 other states, you know, and they've got gas taxes too, and they've got, you know, vehicle fees. They have that, and plus they also supplement, you know, infrastructure and transportation funding out of their general fund. You know, we're in a situation where our Department of Transportation and Development, rather than receiving general fund to pay for things like salaries and benefits and retirement, they've got to use our gas tax money for that. And you know, nobody thinks that's a good idea. But to pay for that with general fund, you're going to have to, you know, come up with other funds. So I think what we'd like to see as the state gets ready for a potential special session to address the fiscal cliff is have that discussion about whether or not part of the general fund should be used, like other states do, 31 other states, to address these monumental problems we've got with transportation. That's a heavy lift. I know that a lot of the focus down at the Capitol is going to be strictly on how do we solve for the shortfall. And you know, it's a capital centric way of thinking down there, where from our perspective, you know, people in the Baton Rouge region and across the state, they're suffering with these terrible road conditions. We think that should be, you know, a general focus of state government, and not just shoving it off to the corner and saying, you know, well, because that's not part of the general fund shortfall, we don't really have to think about it. Transportation, just you're on your own. We think it's rising, has risen to a level where major focus needs to continue to be placed on it.
And, you know, it's interesting because you think that business and big business has so much influence, and I naively thought that when crisis and then the statewide coalition, which y'all named Build It, came together last year and in previous years to, you know, to push for this gasoline tax and these data-driven solutions to big projects, I mean, I really thought that was going to be the difference. You know, hey, the Exxons and the Dows of Louisiana are behind this. And yet, you know, there are forces in the legislature that just can't be reasoned with. It doesn't matter who's behind it, you know.
Well, you know, we
I don't
had
know if
lot
that's fair,
good,
but that's my take on it.
We had a lot of good collaboration. I think, you know, there's just so much business can do on its own. We did have, as you said, a group called Build It out across the state, a lot of grassroots support. One thing we've seen in other states, though, sometimes it takes a lot more than just one bite at the apple to get this done.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as our leaders in the crisis group point out, you know, this problem's not going away. It's just going to get worse with time. So, you know, when we see these solutions coming down and being passed by Republican governors, Republican legislators in other states, sometimes it takes more than one shot. So we don't think the problem's going away. We're not going away, and we're going to keep pressing for a solution. And it may take another shot or two.
Then the thing that I think people don't realize is that even if a gasoline tax passed tomorrow and money was available, you know, how many years realistically does it take to build a new bridge across the river? That doesn't happen in 6 months. You know, that's a years-long process. So there's no end in sight. And in the meantime, our economic development is affected. How much, Michael, does this play into our ability to recruit new companies, new employers to the area? What do y'all hear at the chamber?
It's definitely an issue. It's definitely an issue. You know, one of the strong suits of the Capital Region economy, obviously, over the last few years has been manufacturing, the chemical corridor. We've benefited from a great diversification project with IBM, but you know, our business development guys on the ground, guys and gals on the ground, you know, that's one of the number one things they hear, especially when you're talking about some of these major facilities or expansions. You know, okay, you've done a great job of using your certified sites to find us a great piece of land that's free and clear, and we're ready to go. Oh, by the way, are all of our employees going to be stuck in gridlock? Are our trucks coming in and out going to be stuck in gridlock? So it's definitely something we hear, and it's something that when you talk about all of the Exxons and the Dows and all of these major employers, that's why they're so passionate about this issue as well. But you know, it was also the basis for us getting a consultant using this kind of a planning process through the last year or so, because as you pointed out, you know, people are realistic as well. They understand, you know, even if we get the dollars, it's going to take several years. What they're asking for is what's the blueprint forward? What's a plan? At least show us something, you know, that we can have hope that something is going to happen down the road. And we would like to think that this Capital Region Mobility Strategy that we've been able to put together and release, this is something we can point to and say, look, you know, there may not be dollars for, you know, parts A, B, and C, but here's the game plan. We're helping to bring regional leaders together so that we can start to make a difference in the years to come.
Ray from Prairieville is on the line with a question for you, Michael. Ray, good morning. You're on with Michael DeResto.
Good morning, Stephanie. Thank you for taking the call. Question for both you and Michael. Both have made the comments that the people aren't in favor of the gas tax or the tax to improve the situation. And by the way, I appreciate the fact that they're going to supposedly publicize the plan. But the legislature decided not to let the people vote on it. The gas tax, which we need 17, 25 cents a gallon, because we've got the last tax was in 1990. But the legislature decided not to let the people vote. The people didn't decide that. And the other part about that is we do have to mention what we need is a bypass route. Yes, we need another bridge over, but we need a bypass route leading to that bridge. I'll take my answer on the air, by the way. Thank you very much for taking my call again.
Thank you, Ray. Michael, you want to tackle that first?
Sure, sure. A couple of things that were raised. You know, Stephanie, you asked the question, what are we hearing from businesses? And it's not just businesses. We put out, as you mentioned earlier, our economic outlook. We do a survey every year of investors and the business community and, you know, and citizens. You know, what are your top obstacles for growth? What are the things that are holding the region back? And, you know, it's really not a contest every year. It's transportation and infrastructure. And so we do know the people are in support of this. On the other point, the caller is absolutely right. You know, this is not it's not just about a bridge. You know, when we looked at the major projects and studied them a couple of years ago, there were four main categories of things that could really move the ball here. It is, yes, a new bridge. The other project I mentioned that the state's moving forward on is widening I-10 in Ascension, and there also needs to be those, you know, I guess alternatives to us all just using I-10 through Baton Rouge as a main street. Yes, there needs to be widening of I-10 from the ridge to the split, but as the reader points out, there needs to be something like a bypass. We've gone back and forth for as long as I can remember in the Baton Rouge region whether we should do a northern bypass, whether we should do what's called the bump. You know, our analysis showed both options would be very, very useful in terms of reducing congestion in the region. But again, there needs to be that funding source. I know there's been talk potentially of public-private partnerships for I-10 or the bump, and we think those are things that DOTD needs to explore.
I keep hearing the talk about the public-private partnership, but, you know, I mean, to Ray's point about the people didn't get a voice, you know, in this, nor did the people of East Baton Rouge Parish get to vote on Mayor Broome's plan, but in the type of representative democracy that we live in, you know, it was up to our representatives and our Metro Council members. They made the call. Thanks for calling in, Ray, though. Good point. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. Michael, thanks for joining us. Thank you for being with us on Talk Louisiana. Jim Engster will return tomorrow. Have a great day.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.